time set for oral argument in Sprousen v. State, case number 73674. Are counsel ready to proceed? Please approach, Ms. Westbrook, and tell the clerk what time, if any, you want to reserve for rebuttal.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Justice Pickering, Justice Caraguri, and Justice Kadish. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant, Melvin Sprousen. As a pro se criminal defendant, Mr. Sprousen relied on the district court and the state to know the law and to follow the law. Unfortunately, in this case, the justice system failed. There were 5 very serious constitutional errors that occurred during the trial itself, and I want to briefly just give an overview of those errors at the outset before getting into specifics, because I think it's important to show just how flawed this trial was from beginning to end. First, we had a structural error during voir dire when the court directed a marshal to go out into the hallway and question potential jurors about their qualifications to serve. We have the court excusing 8 of those jurors based on their unsworn out-of-court statements to the marshal. And then we have the court questioning several additional jurors about their disabilities before administering the oath. Second, the court violated Mr. Sprousen's constitutional rights when it applied Nevada's rape shield statutes in a non-rape case and prevented him from refuting and presenting evidence related to the essential elements of all of the 3 different crimes for which he was charged: kidnapping, child abuse, and child pornography. The court committed a 3rd constitutional error when it told Mr. Sprousen, who the court knew at that time to be indigent, that he could not call the state star witness in his case in chief unless he could personally afford to fly her back to Las Vegas from Reno after the state finished presenting its other witnesses. And it wasn't just the court that violated Mr. Sprousen's constitutional rights, it was the state as well, and they did so at every stage of the trial. You had at the beginning of voir dire the state undermining the presumption of innocence by giving what was supposed to be, or what ended up being, a closing argument instead of a neutral introduction. During the trial itself, the state commented on Mr. Sprousen's constitutional rights by presenting expert evidence from a mental health professional, telling the jury that she was suffering mental distress because she was worried about him cross-examining her at trial and him defending himself. In closing argument, the state again commented on his right and his decision to represent himself by highlighting the emotional distress that she was experiencing during the trial for the jury and saying essentially that this speaks louder than anything I could even argue. Any one of these constitutional errors would warrant reversal, but when you combine them all in this case, what you have is a complete miscarriage of justice, and the only possible remedy for that is a new trial. First area I'd like to begin with is the structural error during voir dire. In Baral, this court held that a defendant in a criminal case is denied due process whenever jury selection procedures do not strictly comport with the laws intended to preserve the integrity of the judicial process. And by statute, before prospective jurors can be examined about their qualifications to serve, 2 things have to happen. First, the court needs to administer the oath to make sure the jurors understand their obligations to tell the truth during voir dire. After administering the oath, the court is required to conduct the initial examination of the jurors. These are both mandatory requirements, and as the court explained in Baral, we will not condone any deviation from constitutionally or statutorily prescribed procedures for jury selection. Well, in this case, the court violated both of the mandatory rules.
Can I ask you a question in that regard?
Sure.
You've got Jeremias out there that indicates you have to demonstrate actual prejudice affecting the party's substantial rights. I didn't really address that.
Sure. Jeremias, that aspect of Jeremias only applies if the error is not preserved. And I would initially argue that in this case, the error was preserved because we have a pro se defendant who, he's not in the same position as the defendant in Jeremias. So first of all, let's talk about the defendant in Jeremias. He is represented by counsel, was sitting at counsel table with his attorneys at the time that the state came up and said, we want to close the courtroom. And we've had discussions outside about this, the people that are going to be omitted from the courtroom, and he sat there and did not do anything. And there's very important language in Jeremias where this court basically said that that was even more importantly, perhaps more importantly, Jeremias's failure to object could reasonably be construed as intentional. The closure did not happen under the radar. And then after describing what had happened in court, the court said, while not rising to the level of invited error, correcting the error under these circumstances would encourage defendants who are aware of their rights aware their rights are being violated, to do nothing to prevent it, knowing they can obtain a new trial as a matter of law in the event that they are convicted. This would erode.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I get the point you're making. But in this particular case, there was no objection. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I would actually characterize what he did in court as an objection, because he didn't understand. He was relying on the judge to explain to him what the procedure was for voir dire. And so the judge is basically up there telling him, this is how we do things. I send my marshal out. He questions the jurors. And then at the point when we were in the courtroom, he's saying to the judge, he specifically mentioned, I want to question five jurors. The court allowed him to question two of them. Three of those jurors, he was denied the right to question them. For a pro per, I think that is sufficient. And I cited a number of cases in my reply brief indicating that we construe objections by pro per defendants much more broadly. And the reason we do that is because, you know, he's essentially depending on the court to be doing things the right way.
Well, and this process makes me a little squeamish, quite frankly, but again, beyond Jeremias, didn't he agree to have most of those jurors dismissed?
I don't know that I would say that he agreed. And I think what happens is he says to the court, I'd like to question these people. The court says, well, typically we don't allow this. Typically these people they'd be let go. And then he is kind of like, okay, I'm trusting the court to be doing the right thing. So I don't know that that is on all fours with somebody that is acquiescing to an invited error.
I have a slightly different question, but it's a follow-up. In the Collins case where the defendant, Judge Delaney, kept the defendant out of trial because he refused to don normal clothes and to get out of his jail garb, and there's a discussion about a Second Circuit case, Greer, and the distinction between the preliminary determination of I get that it's not a Burrell situation, but it puts me in mind, the distinction is the preliminary, is the person committed to be out of town, is the person deaf, does the person have a disability that precludes them from serving, versus the more intense voir dire that you engage in. And that it suggests, although it doesn't hold, that phase may be less significant. And and our statute kind of matches that up with saying that the jury commissioner can, or court personnel, whatever the wording of the statute is, can conduct some preliminary assessment of whether the person is in or out of the pool, and then they proceed from there. I'm not comfortable with what occurred in this case, but I'm not comfortable either saying what occurred was structural error. So long way around.
Sure. So I think the reason I think it's structural error in this case is because what the marshal was asking the jurors about, it wasn't just limited to preliminary issues. We know that the jurors were asked, that he asked them questions to the extent that one of them said, you know, she worked with the judge previously. So that's a conflict. That gets to the subject matter of whether there's bias.
And that person was never called in and put under oath.
They were. But what I'm trying to, I guess my distinction here is the process was structural error because of the nature of the questions that that Jason Dean was asking the jurors outside of the courtroom. He basically went out there, and what he did was he said, these are all sorts of things that can get you out of jury service. One of them, you know, obviously, is if you have a conflict, you know the judge. So somebody volunteered and said, yes, I know the judge. Another person said, I am not a U.S. citizen, or apparently said that. We don't know because none of that's sworn. So he is canvassing them about qualifications. You know, that is a flat out violation of our statutes that
but
say the judge
people brought back into the courtroom and sworn later in the process.
A couple of them were,
but not all of them.
Not all of them. In fact, two of them. And this is, I had a footnote in my opening brief that they got to the error about what happened in, you know, that the error continued when they were in the courtroom. Initially, Judge Miley says to them, you know, I know Jason's talked to you, and I know some of you have some physical issues. Two people actually said, you know, hey, one of them, and I've got their names in here, one of them wasn't able to hear out of the right ear, the other wasn't able to see out of the right eye. Both of those people ended up on the jury, and they said, you know, those two people said that it wouldn't be a problem, that they didn't, you know, and it was Johnette Adams and Dennis Hughes. If you want to look at the jury list, it's in volume 5 at page 1123. And then the area where she's questioning them, at that's in the record in volume 10 at 1772 to 75. I mean, basically, like, so we have two people that are on the panel that we don't know whether they meet that qualification standard. And being able to, you know, what is it, NRS 6.010 talks about the qualifications that you have to have, and one of those qualifications is, you know, it talks about your physical ability, you know, your let's see, qualified elector, here it is, under NRS 6.010.
I would rather you address the issue on the evidence and of the victim's sexual relationship.
Sure.
Which David's, whatever.
Sure, and so.
The prior guy, yeah.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So essentially what the court did, you know, the second big error was applying rape shield statutes in a non-rape case. And both rape shield statutes, they're unambiguous. The language is unambiguous as to what types of crimes those statutes apply to. The NRS 50.090 only references criminal prosecutions that involve sexual assault or statutory sexual assault or attempts or conspiracy to commit those crimes. And NRS 48069 only references sexual assault or statutory sexual seduction and related attempts and conspiracy.
But relevance still applies and undue prejudice
still
applies.
Absolutely. In this case, the reason that in my reply brief, I explained why, you know, even if you skip, you know, the rape shield issue, if you look at the first degree kidnapping statute, it talks about a person who leads, takes, entices, or carries away or detains any minor. The state charged Mr. Sprousen with kidnapping by enticement. And in the closing argument, there were 5 transcript pages devoted to the discussion of enticement. You know, and then 16 PowerPoint slides. If you look at the PowerPoint that's at the back of the appendix, there were 16 PowerPoint slides that referenced an enticement theory. The state was talking about grooming, how he groomed her, he gave her a ring, he, you know, took her to his house, he gave her a ride in his lovely red, you know, Mustang. More time was spent on the enticement theory than on any other theory that the state, you know, was arguing for kidnapping. There were other alternative theories, but one of the things, if you look at Mr. Sweeten's closing argument, he made sure that the jury was aware, you can convict him on any of these theories. You don't have to be unanimous. One of you can think it's enticement. Another one of you can think it's, you know, you let her away.
So does it mean she wasn't enticed because she had prior relationships?
That's not what I'm saying.
So how is it relevant?
It's relevant because the way it was presented was that this man was coming after her, and he was doing things, you know, to come after her. Whereas if he was able to present evidence showing, you know, that she seeks out men in these circumstances, I think it would have balanced things a little bit more. And that's just on the kidnapping. The real problem occurred with respect to the substantial mental harm, where the state is really placing everything at this guy's doorstep. And he put them, I mean, that's his own words. I don't want this placed on my doorstep. I don't want this all placed on my doorstep. And the state ended up doing that in closing argument. And the state argued that this woman, this poor girl, you know, she had a normal relationship with her mother. Everything was perfect and peachy keen until Mr. Sprousen came along, and now all of a sudden, you know, she can't even go to a store, you know, where there's a man. She has to have her therapist, you know, teach her again how to interact with society because she's so afraid of men. I mean,
so your point is her prior relationship. I'll give you an extra couple of minutes. You don't have a case behind you, and I'll add 2 to yours as well.
Okay.
There's an issue with respect to substantial mental harm
right.
in this case that concerns me because it's not clear whether a lawyer rather than a pro se would have been able to get more in terms of her prior therapy and the cause of that therapy.
I think the cause of the therapy is really important because what we're talking about is the state is presenting what he did as so egregious that it resulted in her being one of only 10 to 15% of people that her therapist said had to be committed to inpatient treatment. Well, why was she in that 5 to 10, or, you know, 10 to 15% group of people that have to be committed. Well, she, if you look at the record at what happened to her in the prior case, it's egregious. What that other man did to her is egregious, and it's there's a police report in the record.
So your argument legally is that if somebody is already truly damaged, somebody can inflict additional damage on them that's egregious, but the jury, in assessing whether it's substantial or not, should take measure of the pre-existing?
I think it, in order for him to get a fair trial, in order for the jury to have the complete picture of what happened, otherwise they're just assuming that he did everything, and that was why he argues in closing, I don't want to, you know, I'm taking responsibility, but I only want to take responsibility for what I did. And this poor girl, I mean, what happened to her previously was awful.
But the judge allowed evidence that she had pre-existing mental illness, if you will, just not the why of it. But there weren't, in fact, apparently, questions asked that really go to the severity of what her condition was before she met him. In other words, it looks like Mr. Spousen was so focused on trying to get in what happened to her that nobody, and of course he's a pro per, nobody got in what her actual condition was.
It's. I think when you're comparing the egregiousness of what happened previously to what happened in this case, and you have the state making arguments in closing that suggest that she had a normal relationship with her mother and everything was A-okay, that's when you end up with a problem where this evidence really needed to come in order to not deflect, but I guess to counter the somewhat false presentation of the way the state of the evidence was that the state was able to do. So,
thank you. Please preserve 2 minutes for her rebuttal and even it up for the state. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, James Sweeten on behalf of the respondent, State of Nevada. I wanted to respond to both of the issues that were brought up. I wanted to start with the first issue that dealt with jury selection and kind of lay out. I was one of the attorneys who prosecuted this case, and so I was present during the course of it. Respondent submits the dismissal of some of the jurors during this voir dire process commenced error. The state submits that it certainly did not. The record is clear that the jurors were essentially preparing to enter the courtroom. So they were outside. They hadn't entered the courtroom yet. And the bailiff went outside to describe to them sort of the rules of the court, talked to them about what was going to happen, about what sort of excuses were in the court's ordinary course, appropriate excuses for to be released from the jury, which were not. The state would submit that all this is appropriate and normal, both as a courtesy to the jurors as well as just maintain order in the courtroom. Now, in the course of this explanation, the bailiff, and detailing these things, some of the jurors expressed to the bailiff that there were some reasons that they thought might fit within this range. And as a result, these jurors provided information to the bailiff. The bailiff then provided that information to the judge. So before the jury was brought in and voir dire began, the state submits that the court considered that information.
But that wasn't under oath. The judge didn't have an opportunity to test those reasons, which concerns me as a sitting district court judge. I would never do that.
So,
and you know, you've got a process here that you've got to comply with, and I would think it would make the state squeamish that this would occur, and that you'd bring it to the court's attention. That's violative of NRS 16.
Well, let me point two things out in response to that. First, the issues that were brought up by these jurors, a mother who had one of the jurors had a mother who had just had major surgery. She was her only basically caretaker. One of the jurors could not hear. One of the jurors actually had a child who was run over by a school bus, which was an issue that was in the news. The child was in the hospital at the time. There were two individuals who were traveling and had proof of prepaid tickets.
But that's what the jury commissioner does. And again, what makes me squeamish here is the judge didn't have the opportunity to test this. All the time, you know, trying to get juries and trying to pick juries isn't an easy thing because nobody really wants to be there. And they come up with all kinds of excuses to get out of jury duty. That's why I always felt it was an obligation for the judge to do that canvas. And under 16030, subsection 6, you know, it's required.
And the state's position would be that NRS 6.030 states that the court may at any time temporarily excuse any juror on account of a number of reasons, including undue hardship or extreme inconvenience or public necessity. And the statute goes on to state that a person temporarily excused may appear, shall appear for jury service as the court may direct. So the court at any point in time is able to make a determination that a particular jury, for the specified reasons in the statute, is not able to be a jury in the proceeding and can release them. That particular statute puts no requirements in regards to the voir dire process, nothing of that sort. That is an innate responsibility and ability of the judge, and it makes sense because the judge is administering the court. These are issues in regards to these jurors, as the court has indicated, would, in the jury selection process, the court administrators who have been tasked by the court itself, jury services, to make a determination on these individuals and decide, oh yeah, they can't serve because this information has been brought to them. But for these jurors presenting this information earlier to jury services, they would have probably been dismissed earlier before ever getting to the courtroom. They did get to the courtroom. The court was made aware of the issues, which she understood they could have been dismissed even in jury services, which she had the statutory right to dismiss them. But she didn't.
We don't even know. She didn't have an opportunity to put them on her oath and question them to even find out if they made these claims to jury services, and in this case,
I think that the court could have dismissed them. The state's position would be the court could have dismissed them without anything further, but the court did take extra steps. In this particular case, in fact, instead of making the decision on her own, the court actually had the attorneys present, the parties present, and at that point addressed each of the issues that had been presented to her by her bailiff, went through each, one by one, with both the parties present. And as she went through those, the defendant agreed to the dismissal of each and every one of the jurors that were dismissed. There were a few that he says, no, I want to keep them, I want to question them. They were brought in for questioning, save and except for one, and that would be the one juror that indicated they were not a citizen of the United States. In that particular case, the judge says, well, if the juror is not a citizen, they cannot sit on a jury. That was the only issue. The state would submit that the court went over and above what the court was required to, and in this particular case, defense had no objection to what, in fact, the court ultimately did.
Okay, you answered my question. Let you move on to one of the other issues.
So in regards to the issue of the prior sexual history, the respondent submits that the exclusion from evidence of the detail of this prior sexual situation, sexual abuse and victimization suffered by JT at the hands of another perpetrator was improperly excluded.
Let me pause you. One question that occurred to me looking at this case is the standard of review appropriate for us to apply to this. And it seems to me that the state premised its motion on the rape shield statutes primarily with a backup being the general relevance statute. And the court bought the rape shield argument, and it seems to me, reading the record, that the court ruled introducing the detail of what transpired between this victim and the prior older man that she got involved with would violate the rape shield statutes. Our decision on that would be deferential review, but now the state's not defending that, and I don't know that the court really analyzed it under probative versus prejudice general relevance concepts. And if the court didn't exercise its discretion under that statute, is our review appropriately deferential, or is it something closer to what we would have done if we were there.
Well, as an officer of the court, I would tell you, in being in the course of this case, my understanding as a trial attorney in this case was that the court made its decision based upon a weighing of whether it was more probative or prejudicial.
But the court said on the record the rape shield statutes protect this.
My memory...
You got buy-in on that from the court.
My memory was that the court made reference to the rape shield statute, and I think that one of the reasons that the court or that the state brought up the rape shield statute was the general policy that's presented by the rape shield statute, which actually would go to sort of a weighing of the probative value versus the prejudicial effect. And in this case, the state submits that clearly this evidence
was... Except that statute doesn't make the judgment with the charges that were brought in this case that policy should be honored at the expense of whatever probative weight there is to this. I mean, the rape shield statute draws a line, and it doesn't apply in this, given these charges. You're not defending, let me just ask that another way. You're not saying the rape shield statute justified the exclusion of this evidence, are you?
No, and I'm saying that as a trial attorney in the case, that was never my understanding of the reason the court ruled as it did.
Because I know there were... You concede that the charges in this case made reliance on the rape shield statute inappropriate.
Well, I'm saying that in this case, we did not seek to admit it under the rape shield statute. My memory of the case and my understanding of the conversations in the course of the case were such that there was a weighing between probative versus prejudicial.
Okay.
And in this case, the state submits that the court ruled accurately when it came to that. The prior abuse happened when JT was 14. She was 16 at the time of the subject crimes. It was completely separate from the charges, from the crimes charged in this case, and the court found that the actual facts of the prior abuse were not relevant or, at the very least, more prejudicial than probative in this particular case. Now, in regards to first, sort of the two issues that we're talking about, first in regards to the enticement evidence of enticement, because it appears that the appellant contends that the fact that JT had previously run away to be with an older man showed that appellant did not entice her to leave, or arguably that she just left on her own accord. Appellant contends that since he was prohibited from discussing the reasons JT previously run away, he was denied his defense or confrontation. The statute does make entice as the court has indicated, an element along with other elements of the crime of kidnapping. And in the course of arguing this case, the state basically argued the enticement with the lead, kind of those two issues together. Enticement itself is a simple term. I think it's generally understood. The dictionary defines it as offering pleasure or advantage. Appellant specifically discusses in this case JT leaving her home, where to go, when to go, where he was going to take her, bring her birth certificate, various other things. The state submits that clearly evidence satisfies that an element that someone could find that there was enticement here. But respondent submits that whether JT was actually enticed is really irrelevant to this case, because the law is clear and the jury was instructed that there is no requirement that the victim didn't want to leave, only that the victim committed an act of enticement or leading or taking, carrying away, or detaining. The defendant contends that the evidence is necessary to show that JT wanted to leave, even short of that enticement. However, that's not an issue, the respondent would submit. However, I would note that in the course of the jury presentation, that the jury had the benefit of hearing from JT herself, who indicated that she did decide to leave on her own accord and that she did, in fact, leave because she wanted to leave. So the state submits that clearly, in this particular case, the defendant was not denied an ability to cross-examine the victim in regards to the issue of enticement to the extent it was relevant. And clearly any evidence relating to this prior conduct was not relevant in that determination because the victim's mindset herself really was not relevant to the whole issue. Beyond that, getting to the issue of the substantial mental harm, although the court found that the specific facts related to the prior sexual conduct was not admissible, the court specifically found that the evidence of the prior psychological issues of JT, the therapy that she received or was receiving, conflicts with her mother, the fact that she had run away before, all of that information could be brought in. The only thing that was excluded was just the facts of this prior sexual situation with the prior offender. Thus, although the defendant could not get into the specific facts of the prior sexual conduct, he could delve into any of the resulting effects of that conduct as it existed prior to the charged crimes to show the difference in JT's mental state, if any, before and after the subject crimes. And from the testimony elicited at trial, it was clear that prior to the incident that for which the defendant was charged, JT was seeing a therapist before she met appellant a few years back, for a few years actually, that she had previously run away, that she had nightmares. There was a good chunk of evidence that came in to show her mental state prior to these crimes occurring. The state submits that the actual facts of what happened is not relevant to a determination of substantial mental harm. The statute that lays out substantial mental harm essentially defines mental harm in this context as an injury in the intellectual or psychological capacity or emotional condition of a child as evidenced by an observable and substantial impairment of the ability of the child to function within a normal range of performance or behavior.
I am not within his or her normal range, and I think that's where your colleague across the aisle goes with the argument. And I guess I'm puzzled by how far do you evaluate the extent of someone's pre-existing mental injury. And whether, let's take out the pro se piece of this, how far could a lawyer go legitimately in saying this child was grievously damaged by prior incidents in her life? How much do you need to go into those to establish normal range and then the injury this would have inflicted?
I understand. And respondent's position is that I'm not sure how the actual facts of what happened with this other man is at all relevant to that determination. I mean, that determination is a very technical one. What was the mental state prior to these issues, and what is the mental state after? How has this child been affected after?
But, I mean, it has some relevance because if somebody has been terribly abused, that in assessing what is her normal range of function, wouldn't the cause of the injury be relevant to a normal person's assessment of it?
I don't think so. I think it would be prejudicial because different people recover and don't recover at different rates. If you were to go back and you were to bring it, it's almost talking, you know, apples and oranges, because you have a horrendous thing that happened. Maybe that person has recovered to a point where they're functional and they're good. Maybe someone else has not. The real issue is what is their mental state?
Maybe something small was more grievous to somebody than it would be to another person. Not, and in this case, nothing was small, but I mean, it's a difficult statute.
And I understand, you know, the court's concern, but as I said before, I don't know how we're talking about a lay jury, how bringing in another inflammatory act is going to really get to actual an analysis of what is their mental situation before and what is their mental situation after.
Well, did evidence come? Sorry, yeah. Did evidence come in of what her mental situation was before?
Yes, there was evidence presented both by the state and by the defense in regards to the fact that prior to this incident happening, that she was undergoing therapy for about a couple years, that she had previously run away, that she had a history of having nightmares. It also came in that she was in a stable relationship with her mother where she lived in the household. She was attending school on a daily basis. She was doing those sorts of things. She was able to communicate with individuals, do things like that. And then after As the court is aware, there was testimony as to her mental state at that point, and it was a mental state that had broken down to a point that she wasn't able to go to school. She wasn't able to do the normal things of everyday life. She was contemplating suicide. These were things that she was doing after that she clearly was not doing before. There was obviously a change, and the one determining factor that contributed to that change the state submitted was the defendant, the conduct of the defendant.
Thank you. You're out of time.
I'm out of time. I'm sorry.
Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.
Okay, just briefly. Justice Pickering, you're absolutely right. The court based its ruling, the state requested a ruling on Rape Shield. The state asked for the evidence to be excluded based on Rape Shield, and the court excluded the evidence based on Rape Shield. So I think right there you have an abuse of discretion. The court's decision was wrong. The court got the law wrong. And the result of the court getting the law wrong was the state being able to go in and make representations in closing argument about the state of this woman's mental state beforehand and how it was so much worse after, without giving the jury the full picture so that they could really compare before and after.
Well, why does the jury need to know what caused the prior harm if they were allowed to present medical testimony that indeed she was damaged and hurting before this?
The problem is, it makes it look like he is just this awful person as compared to, she just generally has vague issues. And it looks like then that he preyed on her
he did prey on her. The fact that someone else preyed on her before doesn't excuse what he did.
The concern is we have the elements of the crimes at issue. Enticement is an element of the crime. So he is entitled to refute that specific element. If she is out there and going online and looking to make relationships, if she is out there sending pictures of herself to another man, and there are pictures that already exist of herself that she sent to Mr. Schloman, that's actually in the police report. There were topless pictures that were taken. If she had those pictures and she is already, some of the issue is, was he the one that enticed her to do that? And in the sexual portrayal statute, there's actual, that enticement language is in there. Was he the one that caused the pictures to be sent? So I think it is absolutely relevant to know what was her behavior beforehand.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're out of time. I want to thank both counsel for their excellent briefs and oral argument. This is a difficult case. We'll be in recess in the case is submitted. Thank you.